Stop and think for a moment about the last non-animal product you ate or drank. There's a good chance it was something containing seeds. We eat a lot of them, and we have lots of other uses for seeds in our diet, in our wardrobe, and all around us in daily life. This hour's guest takes note of the ubiquity in his book, The Triumph of Seeds. Tor Hansen is a conservation biologist, the winner of a fellowship from the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation, and the author of a couple of previous books, The Impenetrable Forest and Feathers, which won or is nominated for several awards. He grew up in and now lives in Washington State, and if his voice sounds familiar, it's because he's been a guest of both Fresh Air and The World, both heard here in the afternoons on this station. Tor Hansen, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thanks for having me on, Jeffrey.
There's a good story in here about how you got interested in seeds and what led up to this book. Who instigated that process?
Well, it has roots in my own past in my doctoral research, which was on the seed dispersal and genetics of big rainforest trees down in Central America. So when I was casting about for a new book idea, seeds were on my short list, but the real clincher and what decided it for me was my young son, who at that age, and still he's five now, but was younger then, had an absolute fascination with seeds, was constantly taking apart fruit and pulling out these seeds and showing them to me. And here I am thinking about, well, what am I going to write next? And he'd hold up these seeds, and his pronunciation at that time as a young child was, as many kids have the same problem, saying S's. So instead of developing a lisp, he simply replaced S sounds with something he could say, which was a hard H, which meant that every time, day after day, he'd be holding up handfuls of seeds to me and shouting, "Heed, heed, Papa." And I finally did heed the seeds and decided that this indeed would be the subject for my next book.
Yeah, and in fact, the preface is called Heed, so you named it none of your son's description of it. Your timing here is really good. Your timing here in the exchange, I mean, in the sense that the county from which we originate passed an anti-GMO ordinance a year ago, and seeds are very much the focus. And why don't we start there? How big a deal are seeds in the GMO debates?
Well, I find it absolutely fascinating that seeds are at the center of the GMO controversy. You know, when I read those stories, I have to ask myself, well, why seeds? You know, we have GMO labs churning out everything from featherless chickens to glow-in-the-dark cats to goats that produce spider silk. So why is it that it's seeds we feel we must rally around and defend? And I think that speaks to a very deep and profound cultural connection to seeds, and that's part of what I explore in the book.
And you mentioned some genetic modifications of your own in a one-credit graduate seminar you took in college. What happened there?
Well, this is, I mean, it's a good example of the technology. I took just a one-credit class to familiarize myself with the workings of a genetics lab. I was going to do some genetic work on these trees I was studying. And the exercise that we did in that lab was a simple form of cloning, taking bits of DNA from ourselves and inserting them into bacteria that would then reproduce that bit of DNA when they multiply. And, you know, it was very crude, of course, and it was only a tiny smidgen of DNA involved in this process. But I kept thinking to myself, my gosh, I should not be able to clone myself in a one-credit class. I mean, this technology is in some ways getting perhaps a little too easy for our own good.
Should it have been a three-credit class or something?
Yeah, maybe three credits.
Let's talk then about the overall ubiquity of seeds. I mean, give us some examples in daily life. You start us off in the book with coffee, but where does it tend to go from there for a lot of us?
Oh, if you imagine a day without seeds, the prospects are truly grim. You would wake up, first of all, on a bare mattress because you wouldn't have cotton for the sheets or the mattress pad or your pajamas, for that matter. Cotton comes to us from the seed coats, the fluffy seed coats of a plant in the mallow family. And then you might stumble out to the kitchen to have your breakfast, and of course there'd be no coffee, and there'd be no bagel or toast or oatmeal or anything to go with it. All of those things come to us from seeds, and you might think, well, gosh, you know, at least I can console myself with a chocolate bar, but you can forget it, of course, because chocolate comes to us from the seeds of a South American rainforest tree, cacao. So it's truly remarkable how seeds surround us all day long, you know, involved in everything from food to fracking, for that matter.
In fracking? Explain that one.
Oh, it's a wonderful story. And again, what I find so fascinating about this is that all of these uses that we have for seeds are rooted in very intriguing biological and evolutionary stories as well, and fracking is a good example. The process of hydraulic fracturing relies on opening up cracks and seams deep in the rock.
Spreading things apart, in essence.
Yes, yeah. So you pressurize these fracking wells, and you have to insert a fluid into those cracks that will open them and help keep them apart. And the fluid has to be thick. It has to have a certain consistency. And the best thing that they have found to thicken that fluid is from the ground-up seeds of a cluster bean that grows in northern India called guar. And guar gum has gone up tremendously in value since the fracking boom began several years ago. So this plant, these seeds that were, you know, it's a legume, like a bean, and you know, the people in northern India were feeding this to their livestock not too long ago, and all of a sudden they are selling it for top dollar, and it's being used around the world to thicken the fluid inserted into fracked wells. It's a fascinating story, and of course, the reason it's such a good thickener is because it evolved in this dry, hot climate in India, this desert-like condition where the seeds not only provide nutrition, you know, to the baby plant inside, but they've also adapted to just grab onto every water molecule that gets anywhere near that seed in an attempt to store up enough moisture to germinate. And that ability to grab onto water makes them a marvelous thickener.
All right. Well, if you're looking for guar gum in the stores and not understanding why it's gone so high in price, now you know. It's got something to do with fracking. Tor Hansen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Triumph of Seeds. We'll come back and talk more about the many ways in which we use seeds and the many ways in which they've adapted remarkably to their surroundings. Much more to talk about with Tor Hansen and The Triumph of Seeds on the Jefferson Exchange with you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the conservation biologist Tor Hansen, biologist and author of several books. His latest is called The Triumph of Seeds, How Grains, Nuts, Kernels, Pulses, and Pips Conquered the Plant Kingdom and Shaped Human History. It's a great discussion about all the many ways in which we depend on seeds, ways in which you might not be aware until you read the book. Join us on the Exchange for the discussion about seeds, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Tor, I suppose we should pause here and stop to ask, without seeds, how do some plants make new plants?
Ah, that's a great question. And in fact, it reminds us that for millions of years, seeds didn't exist. And the dominant way that plants reproduced was via spores. The spore plants dominated the flora, huge forests of ferns and horsetails and spike mosses and things, all the way up through parts, you know, of the Carboniferous era. And, you know, seeds evolved from the spores. They triumphed over them in the end because they developed a series of really useful traits that gave them a real advantage over spores. Where a spore is just a tiny blip that drifts off in the wind and contains no nutrition or anything for making a baby plant, it's a much different system. Seeds developed all of these things by supplying nutrition for the plant inside. The botanist would call a seed a baby plant in a box with its lunch. And so you have the lunch in there. You have a box that helps protect the seed. You have chemicals to protect the seed. You have a means for the seed to travel, and you have this wonderful ability of seeds to go dormant and endure in the soil until the conditions are right for sprouting. So those things gave the seeds a real advantage over spores, and now spore plants are still with us, ferns and mosses, but usually in miniature and always as a minor component of the flora now dominated by seeds.
Can we assume then that for evolutionary purposes, seeds are just a better way to propagate?
Well, better isn't necessarily the right term.
No judgment implied.
Yeah, you know, I should say my book is not, it was called Down with Spores, Good Old Spores. They still they still work pretty well. You know, we still do have a great diversity of ferns and mosses and things in our flora. But certainly seeds gave the seed plants a real advantage, particularly in dry areas. The spore reproduction system is reliant on moisture, on water at some point during that process, because they still produce swimming sperm that have to swim through a bit of moisture to reach the egg and fertilize the egg, whereas the seed plants have developed a system of reproducing through pollination that can happen just on the wind and can happen via animals like bees or birds. So it is a more versatile system, certainly, and one that is very handy for most terrestrial situations.
You talked about the ability for seeds to lie dormant until the conditions are right, and I'm reminded that there are some seeds that require certain sets of conditions to do their business, including ones that, and this is a big feature, obviously, of the fire-prone regions of Southern Oregon and Northern California, but some seed cones, I understand, that only release their seeds when they've been exposed to high temperatures, even fire?
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. Dormancy is a mysterious process to us still, but it has evolved a great variety of specific mechanisms adapted to particular environments. And your example of the fire systems is a really good one. We think often of seeds dispersing through space, you know, drifting off in the wind or being carried away inside a fruit by a hungry animal. But dormancy really allows plants to disperse their seeds through time, to put that seed at a point sometime in the future that is best for it to germinate and support the growth of a baby plant. So in a fire-prone system, the best time usually for a baby plant to get started is after a fire has moved through and opened up the understory, so there's plenty of real estate available, and deposited this great deposit of fresh ash that will add nutrients to the soil. That's the time you want to get started as a plant. So seeds over, you know, the great iterations of evolution in those systems, many of them have developed requirements that must be met before they can germinate. There are actually things in the seed inhibiting germination, either physically or chemically. And in some cases, they need to be exposed to great heat. In some cases, they need to be exposed to wood smoke before they will actually germinate. So it's a marvelous way for that parent plant to ensure that germination happens at the right moment in the future.
Tor Hansen's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Triumph of Seeds. So among the conditions, I mean, do some have to be exposed to digestive juices? Because I'm aware of the many seeds that get consumed by animals and then pooped by them. Is that actually part of the germination process for some seeds?
It is in many ways. And it's not always clear whether or not they have to go through a digestive tract to germinate. But there are many instances where studies show it's obvious that digestion enhances their germination. So many more seeds will germinate if, in fact, they're ingested by an animal and pass through the digestion. And that can happen in a couple of ways. It may be the chemical process of digestion that changes the seed coat, and it can also have to do with simply the physical process of being consumed. For example, the marula fruit in South Africa, which is consumed by elephants and has a stony pit in it, this incredibly hard seed that only really opens up after an elephant has chewed on it. The elephant knocks loose a little plug in that hard, hard shell that allows water to enter eventually and allows the seed to germinate. So it can be a physical disturbance, it can be a chemical process, or sometimes simply the added benefit of being deposited in a very nice fertilizer being the poop of the animal itself.
I'm struck by the number of different ways in which seeds get scattered. I mean, obviously there's the wind, but then there are the fact that, for example, foxtails are ubiquitous in the drier parts of our region, and so we can get them stuck in your socks, and you end up carrying the foxtails many miles away and probably creating new foxtail plants as a result. There are the things we just mentioned where animals will eat them and poop them out, and they get distributed that way. So it's just a whole bunch of different ways that seeds manage to get themselves scattered around the world.
Yeah, the adaption for travel is incredibly diverse in seeds, and I love your example of the foxtail in that you're being manipulated by the plant, in a sense. You're being manipulated in that situation by the evolution of that plant, in that if you feel that seed in your sock after you've walked a distance, right? It doesn't immediately poke you. And you immediately get down and yank it out. No, it works its way in over some hundreds of yards or miles or whatever.
It is barbed, come to think of it, yes.
Yeah, and it works itself in, and finally it drives you nuts, and you have to sit down and get it out. Well, what have you done? You've dispersed that seed quite a distance before you pull it out, and it works the same way in animal fur as well. It doesn't immediately poke the animal. You don't drop the seed immediately under the plant where you acquired it. You walk away until it gets so annoying that you finally pull it out and effectively disperse that seed.
Tor Hansen, again, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a conservation biologist who lives in Washington State. His third book is called The Triumph of Seeds, How Grains, Nuts, Kernels, Pulses, and Pips Conquered the Plant Kingdom and Shaped Human History. And we're talking about the many, many features of seeds and the many, many ways in which we make use of them here on the planet. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Ryan and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tor Hansen.
Well, this is a fascinating conversation. I remember as an undergraduate biology major with a focus on animals, I was forced to take a botany class. And kind of,
against your will.
Like against my will was, but I was just fascinated by how weird things got. I mean, in terms of the options for sexual reproduction and all of the rest of the stuff. And as you're talking about these amazing invasives who can hunker down and wait for the disturbance or who have particularly good seed types to disperse. And it gets me thinking about the antithesis of the diversity. And so I'm hearkening back to that, the genetically modified or even just the old school genetics of, there only being a tiny handful of corn varieties now that are planted or rice varieties that are now planted. And I am worried about that loss of diversity and appreciation. So how does that fit into your story?
All right, great question. Thanks for that, Ryan.
Yeah, it's a terrific question. And Ryan, I'll tell you, too, I have a pin that I'm looking at right now. It's on my bulletin board in my office, and it says, plants are wildlife, too. So I can recommend that to remind us all how interesting botany can be. And your question really gets to something very timely about seeds and the conservation of seeds at this moment in time, where indeed we've seen a great loss of the diversity of not only wild plants that have lost habitat, but of the crops that we plant. Over our history as an agricultural society, we had developed a huge range of specific varieties, adapted to every valley and village around the world where we grew these crops. And it's only within the last 100 years or so that we have narrowed what we plant to a very few varieties of our crops and lost a great deal of diversity. So there are two main ways that we're trying to preserve what we have remaining. And one of those is the seed bank movement. So the idea of gathering up as many varieties of crops and wild plants that are still out there and storing those seeds in refrigerated, controlled conditions that will extend their life so we always have a record of these seeds and can go back to those to breed crops or to replant or whatever in the future. So we have a marvelous seed bank here in the United States, many of them, but the largest is our national seed bank in Fort Collins. And now there are backup copies from seed banks around the world going to a vault up in the Arctic at Svalbard in Norway, into a seed bank carved into the side of a mountain, where even if the power goes out, it will still be a cold place where seeds can survive for a long time. So that's one aspect of it. And the other, of course, is to try to keep planting a great variety of seeds. So the heirloom vegetable and crop movement led by such groups as the Seed Savers Exchange in Decorah, Iowa, is trying to encourage people to keep sharing seeds among neighbors and friends and keep planting them in our gardens or keep planting them in farm fields, so that we not only maintain the diversity we have, but that those crops continue to adapt to the changing conditions that we have around us. And so that's another important aspect of it, and one that we all play a role in when we shop, in that we should always buy the odd varieties if we can find them, because it ensures that there will be a market for these things, whether it's, you know, at the grocery store, the farmer's market, or even in a restaurant. If you see an unusual variety of a crop, try it out. Try it out, because you're helping ensure that we plant a variety of things.
Because otherwise, the pull of the market, it sounds like, results in something of a downward spiral in the availability of that plant.
It does, yeah. We lose the diversity that we spent thousands of years creating in agriculture. We lose it when we only buy one variety or two varieties of corn or tomato or lettuce or whatever it may be.
We are talking to Tor Hansen about the triumph of seeds here on the Jefferson Exchange. And Vajra Ma in Sunny Valley sent in an email about the very thing you were just talking about, the saving of seeds. She says, what an important issue. People around the world are saving seeds. One example is what Vandana Shiva, nature advocate in India, has founded. Navdanya, Nine Seeds, is actively involved in the rejuvenation of indigenous knowledge and culture. It has created awareness on the hazards of genetic engineering, defended people's knowledge from biopiracy and food rights in the face of globalization. It has its own seed bank and organic farm spread over an area of 45 acres in Uttarakhand, North India. Navdanya has so far successfully conserved more than 5,000 crop varieties, including 3,000 of rice, 150 of wheat, 150 of kidney beans or rajma, 15 of millets, and several varieties of pulses, vegetable, medicinal plants, etc. So just underscoring what you were just talking about, Tor, where lots of people saving lots of seeds.
Yeah, it's a very important movement, and that's a good one where you're combining planting and keep, making sure that those things are still planted with a seed bank at the same time. So doing all that we can to preserve this great diversity. There's a fascinating story, too, about how this really got started, or I should say the first person who really appreciated this in a big way was a Russian scientist named Nikolai Vavilov in the teens and the 20s. Who realized this and started the first global seed bank in St. Petersburg. He traveled the world gathering seed varieties and learned that, there are centers of diversity for crops wherever they were originally domesticated, because those are the places where people have been growing them the longest, and you have this huge diversity. It's crops that are resistant to certain diseases in one part of the country, but here the same crop can grow at a very high altitude in another part. People have had time to adapt them to all these conditions. And preserving that is incredibly important, particularly now when we're facing rapid climate change and we'll very likely need to adapt the crops that we're growing to meet the new conditions in the years ahead. So it's a very important movement for our own survival as well as for the survival of all these varieties.
I wonder how carefully the seeds have to be stored, though, if some extreme measures have to be taken to prevent the seeds from germinating.
Well, it's a great question. What is the procedure for storing all these seeds? Our national seed bank has over 2 billion seeds in storage and thousands of varieties of various crops and wild plants. So how do you do it? Well, you keep them very cold, you keep them dark, you keep them dry. For most seeds, those conditions will help extend their life. But it's not the sort of situation where you just turn the key and walk away. We think of a seed bank or a vault, and it's all locked away someplace. But that's not the case, because even in perfect conditions, seeds deteriorate over time. They lose viability. So you need to be constantly checking the viability of the seeds, trying to germinate a few. And in fact, if you see the viability drop below a certain threshold, you have to send those seeds out to a farm someplace so someone can grow them into adult plants and harvest a new fresh batch of seeds to replenish the seed bank. So the seed bank process is not just a vault somewhere. It is a network of growers associated with that bank who can keep the seeds fresh.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of work.
It is indeed.
Speaking of a lot of work, let's talk about some of the places you've gone in search of seeds and some of the dangers you've encountered along the way.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Well, there's a chapter in the book talking about some of my doctoral research on a fascinating tree in Central America, and it's huge seeds that are, you know, considered sort of a keystone for the rainforest there, because so many things feed upon the fruits and the seeds within. And part of doing that research, of course, was walking straight lines through the forest, gathering seeds, and you know, you're bent over low to the ground, messing around in the leaf mulch. So it would probably come as a surprise to many people, but the study of rainforest seeds involves a lot of encounters with pit vipers and furtelants and other poisonous snakes that call that place home. So seed research is dynamic stuff.
Not just picking them up off the farm by any stretch of the imagination. Tor Hansen's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Triumph of Seeds. We'll come back and talk more with him and take more of your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. And who knew seeds could be so much fun? Tor Hansen is our guest today. He's a conservation biologist, the winner of a fellowship from the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation, and the author of three books, including the latest, The Triumph of Seeds, How Grains, Nuts, Kernels, Pulses, and Pips Conquered the Plant Kingdom and Shaped Human History. A fun discussion about the many ways in which we use seeds, from the morning coffee to the cotton in our sheets, all kinds of stuff around us and in us from seeds. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Jamie in Medford, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Tor.
Howdy.
Good morning.
I was just going to bring up something a little whimsical, a little off the topic perhaps, but I'm talking about chia seeds. Now, about a dozen years ago, it was like they had a terracotta form that you would plant the seeds on, and they would grow.
Chia, yeah.
coming up a little farther, in like about 5 years ago, who knew how beneficial chia seeds were for our diet? So I just thought maybe Tor could address that if he knows anything about that.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. Chia seeds have really come along as a nutritional
thing. I'll take it off
thing.
The air.
Thanks, Jamie. Appreciate that. So, Tor, what makes chia seeds so good for us, and what makes them do that wacky thing on the terracotta heads?
Yeah, great, great question. I love it. Who knew we should have been eating those chia pets, not just admiring them? But indeed, you know, the chia seeds are very nutritious, and it points out really the diversity that goes on within seeds. We've been talking a lot about the diversity of strategies for germination and the diversity of the form and function of seeds. But even inside a seed, there's a great diversity in how that seed, for example, stores the energy that it has within it to fuel plant growth. It can be stored in the form of starches, which we see in you know, things like wheat and oats, the grass seeds. It can be stored in the form of protein, which we see in nuts and things. It can be stored in the form of fats and oils, where we get our canola oil and other things. And so chia seeds have a very complex but very nutritious combination of energy forms within the seed that were designed, of course, to fuel the growth of the baby plant. But because that nutrition is there, we can use it to fuel our own germination, so to speak. We can use those same nutrients to nourish ourselves. And the other aspect of chia, which you see when you sprout those things on your terracotta form, is the wonderful germination process, which is something, of course, that begins to change very quickly the chemistry of the nutrients within the seed, as they are, what they say in botany, mobilized to start to fuel the growth of the sprout. The chemistry of them changes, and the nutritional value changes as well, which is why you see now a whole range of sprouted grain products and breads and things as well. The nutritional component of them is different because the chemistry changes as soon as they start to sprout. So I think the chia is a wonderful example for us of nutrition of seeds and how it varies and how it changes when they start to grow.
I'm glad you filled in that part at the end, because I did notice that a lot of sprouted seeds being cited as good nutrition at this point in time, and you got right there. John in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tor Hansen, the author of The Triumph of Seeds.
Thanks. So my question is, what are we getting, I guess you'd say, the best bang for your buck? You know, let's say we took so many acres, like 100 acres, and you planted probably the big crops in the world are rice, wheat, corn, soy. Which ones are really have the real bang for your buck? And which, you know, we've heard sometimes that beef is, for what it is, beef takes up a lot of land, et cetera, and could be used in different ways. But what about all this wheat?
So we're talking the most stuff, nutrition, for example, for the least amount of land?
Or something like that. Or maybe you get the most crop out of whatever it is we're planting. It could be, there's all sorts of stuff to plant.
Okay, well, anyway, thanks for that, John. Appreciate it. Tor?
Yeah, great question. So you have, there's no one answer to that question, but what is, I think, really informative is to look at how people have answered that question through trial and error in the birth of agriculture around the world. If you look at the places where plants have been domesticated, almost invariably you find that people have domesticated something starchy, like a grass or a grain, along with a legume, something that is, you know, a lentil or a bean or something with a lot of protein. And when you combine those two, you end up with a complete protein, which, you know, you can then base a diet on and base a civilization on. So we've seen this around the world. We see it with wheat and barley and lentils and garbanzos and things in the Middle East in the Fertile Crescent. You see it with rice and mung beans and soy in Asia. You see it in the New World with corn and the pinto bean style of bean. Almost everywhere we've made the transition to agriculture, people have figured out that growing something starchy and growing a legume at the same time will give you a complete meal, in a sense. And that forms the basis of diets around the world. So in terms of yield, yields on these things change dramatically depending on the conditions where you're growing them and what kind of inputs you put in terms of, you know, the style of agriculture. So there's no real set answer for yield, but there's certainly an answer for nutritional value and what people have learned to do over time, combining, you know, the rice and beans sort of idea on a grand scale.
Okay, the complete protein there. Well, it was, speaking of proteins, we're going to cross back into the animal kingdom for an email from Jerry, no town given. He asks, if you've looked at earthworm eggs, your discussion of seeds reminds me of how earthworms have spread around the world.
Yeah, I have not done research on earthworm eggs, but there's something very intriguing there that your answer, your question addresses, and that is this idea of things that can lie in the soil for a long time before sprouting or before coming, in a sense, back to life. It's very rare in animals. You know, we see something similar to a seed really only in a few groups, the most famous being perhaps found at the end, the last pages of a comic book, where you see an advertisement for sea monkeys. Sea monkeys, of course, are a brine shrimp,
right,
which evolved in, you know, desert conditions where the pools where the shrimp live go dry and might be dry for, you know, a year or more. So the shrimp have learned to desiccate to become extremely dry, the little reproductive parts there, so that they can come back to life when it rains and the pools are flooded again. This is very unusual in animals, but of course in plants, seeds do this all the time. seeds go dormant. They dry out almost completely, and they can last for a year, for a decade, in some cases hundreds or even thousands of years, waiting for the right conditions to germinate and come back to life through imbibing the moisture around them and sprouting back into a full-grown plant. So, you know, this idea of something in the soil waiting for the right conditions is inherent in seeds and very rare in animals.
When we were talking about the earthworms and the dormant period, I was thinking about the brine shrimp in Lake Abert in Oregon, south central Oregon, which is nearly dry now, about 1% of its usual pool. But the brine shrimp eggs will sit there and wait for the water to come back.
Absolutely.
Let's go to Jacob in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tor Hansen, the author of The Triumph of Seeds.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to bring up the topic of the agricultural revolution and industrial agriculture. We had a scenario in the 40s and the 50s that we were actually going to outstrip our food supply, like Hobbes predicted, but it did not happen. And part of the reason why it did not happen is because of the agricultural revolution. Surprisingly, humans are dependent on only about 5 species of crops. You know, and it's not walnuts and it's not tomatoes. Only 5 crops actually provide 90% of our calories. Some people estimate 60 to 90%, but it's rice, corn, wheat, barley, and soy. And those also lead into the feedstocks that lead into animals that we eat, like beef and pig and cattle and chickens and everything. So that's why it could be as high as 90%. But we are dependent on only 5 species, and the reason how the industrial agriculture and GMO made such a big impact was they concentrated on those 5 crops. And one of the researchers was Norman Borlaug, who actually got the Nobel Prize for his research on wheat. But they made wheat from being kind of a wasteful species into being very highly productive. And instead of being leggy and long, it was actually more uniform and short, and it had big berries, you know, and that just little things like that actually made humans, you know, help them avert like a food catastrophe and the agricultural revolution. I know it's not, I know a lot of people disagree with it, but you can't argue with, you know, what brings home the bacon and what pays the rent, and it's those 5 species or 5 seeds and the success that we've had in the last 20 years with breeding them.
All right. Thanks for that, Jacob. Appreciate it. Any thoughts to follow up with there, Tor?
Sure. And another thing to keep in mind is that the bulk of the improvements that we've made in agriculture over time, including the types of things you're talking about with wheat and short stature and fat seeds, was done through traditional plant breeding. We've always been at it, you know, making different varieties of things, and the plant breeding has become much more sophisticated. Even traditional forms of plant breeding have become much more sophisticated over the last 50 or 100 years. So, yeah, great point in that the improvements we've made to these certain crops have increased production, along, of course, with the changes in how we fertilize them and grow them as well.
Here's a call from Anya in Cave Junction. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tor Hansen.
Oh, hi, that's me.
Yes.
I really like this show, and I was thinking that seeds, without seeds, there would be no life on Earth, I don't think. But anyway, I was thinking two things. What would be the possible consequences of, I understand that Monsanto took certain seeds from some seed banks, different seed banks, and put their patents on them. That's one thing. And the other one, whatever happened with Ignacio Chapala? He was a professor, I think biology at Berkeley, and in Oaxaca, Mexico, was a area where they held maybe 100 varieties, I don't know how many, 100 varieties of indigenous corn. And
well, let's see what Tor knows about that. Thanks for the call, Anya.
Yeah, okay. great call. Thank you. So the debate going on about GMOs and some of the patenting that Monsanto and others have done, patenting particular seed varieties, really brings up the fact that this technology has now joined a long line of technologies that we have invented, from nuclear power to the use of drones to cloning, that we struggle to make peace with. So the debate is really trying now to put some kind of parameters on the use of these technologies. And it's an extremely important debate regarding seeds because, as you point out, we are so dependent upon them. And there's no one single answer that's going to satisfy everyone. We're going to be debating this for a long, long time. But it's a very important debate. And what I've tried to do with this book is to give us the background and answer the question of why we care so much about seeds in the first place. Why is it that, you know, polls consistently find people more comfortable with the idea of changing their own genome or the genomes of their children for medical purposes than they are with the idea of altering the genes in seeds? So we have a deep cultural connection and a very profound dependence upon seeds, and that is why they're at the heart of this debate and why they're so worthy of it.
Given all the seeds that you have taken into account in the book, and there are so many great stories that, that come along with these seeds, is there one that, that most impresses you or you found most indestructible or just the weirdest seed you found anywhere in the world?
There's so many. Well, I mean, the one that probably is most critical to daily life for you know, for the writing process is coffee.
Right.
I probably should have listed Coffee Beans as a co-author on this particular volume. And in fact, they're fascinating in many ways, as so many of these seeds are. It's a wonderful way, really, to learn about the natural world in daily life, is to observe the seeds around you and then to explore the biology and the stories behind them. But coffee, of course, we drink because it contains caffeine. Well, why is coffee caffeinated in the first place? It turns out that caffeine is an extremely useful pesticide, among other things. So it slows the growth of fungal pests. It drives off hornworm beetle larvae and other things that attack coffee plants. So that's why it evolved, and its benefit to us is somewhat secondary.
It's weird to think we're drinking a pesticide every day.
Exactly, yeah. The marketers don't want to hear it, but it is, in fact, a pesticide that we're after with our morning cup.
It really is a fascinating book, The Triumph of Seeds. Tor Hansen wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Tor, thanks so much.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Same here.